Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Joining me in studio is a man who just completed a run of Young Frankenstein the Musical at Richmond Civic Theater, and we're going to break down everything from stage to screen and stuff we show our spouses, and just, it's like, as I told him, it's like lunch without the food. Andy Dudas is in studio with me. Hi, Andy.
I was told there would be food.
Thank you.
My Dixie cup of water will suffice.
And there will
be
breakfast food.
All day.
Bacon and eggs.
That's right. Bring me all the bacon you have.
Yes. We also have lunch and movie and TV quotes, as you can already tell. So Andy is also a part of the Department of Improv, which is an improv troupe based in Richmond, Indiana, and one of the proprietors of the Diva Space in Richmond. Full disclosure, I'm a board member and one of the performers, as is Andy. And we'll get to that in a little bit.
Yes. The Dudas Inspiration Venue for the arts,
that's where the diva comes
in. There we go.
So, all right. Opening in theaters this week, and I have to say, so I got to see some stuff in the theater recently after a long stretch of not seeing stuff in the theater. As a critic, I have stuff that is occasionally sent to me, screener links or DVDs, or sometimes there's the morning press screenings, and also the fact that we're in the post Academy Awards lull, and it's going to be just these kind of films before we get into summer blockbuster season, which would, the way things are going, will probably be early April. It used to be May, it used to be July, and now it's like Christmas specials.
It's almost like a presidential campaign.
Yeah, very good. But opening in theaters this week is the thriller Us, the new film from writer, director, producer, Academy Award winner Jordan Peele, his follow-up to Get Out. Okay. This is one of those films where I don't want to give away a whole lot, and if you have not seen the trailers, don't look for them. But those who have, so I'm warning you, it stars Lupita Nyong'o, who of course won an Academy Award for 12 Years a Slave. She was in last year's Black Panther, and she is the matriarch of a family that are out on vacation in what appears to be north coastal Northern California. Elizabeth Moss is also in this as their best friends. Beach companions, that sort of thing. If you've seen the trailers, and again, if you haven't, skip ahead. But the trailer itself looks like a kind of home invasion, the first Purge kind of feel to it. It's more than that. And I don't want to give away what it meshes into. I would like you to have that element of surprise. Maybe not quite like From Dusk Till Dawn, but something of that ilk. So there are two subgenres of the horror film genre that are meshed well in this. That being said, obviously everybody's intrigued to see what the follow up to Get Out was going to be, especially because it won an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay and had some big social statements in this. And once the film came out, I started reading other people's reviews, and I wondered if there was going to be a breakdown of symbolism this meant this, this means that. There's a couple, there's some flashback scenes from the 80s involving Hands Across America, some VHS tapes, and a fun house that's, of course, not so fun. But I don't, I think, and maybe Jordan Peele is waiting until he can do the DVD commentary track, which, by the way, is a lot of fun because at least in Get Out, he's telling you this is an homage to this, this is an homage to that, and maybe he and he probably won't even tell us all the homages. He'll keep some of I'm sure he will keep to himself. I don't think this film is trying to make as big of a political social statement as his previous film, but it is still a well-made thriller. Well done. And he grew up watching a lot of these films. We saw it in a packed house earlier this week, and moments that, of course, are cliche and are supposed to happen, walking slowly down a hallway. But because it's shot well, it's acted well, you're in for this ride. It's one thing if we're watching and did you watch the cheap slashers when in the first incarnation of a home video?
A few of them. I mean, it was full disclosure, and I was 12 or 13 years old, so there was
well,
a few.
Well, we all were.
Yeah, right. So
some of us still are.
It's nice, though, to hear the direction you're going with your view on this film and his previous film, because it's kind of a cheap way to make a buck in Hollywood, is to throw out a quote-unquote horror movie. And this is not just all that these are.
Right. And I think there's a few moments that happen. I think you're going to bring your own path with you on certain moments of the film and what it may mean or not mean. I'm still being very vague on this. But if you can make a grown-up genre picture, mm-hmm. and I kept thinking the first one that pops to mind is Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. And there's some visual elements to Kubrick in this film. Not an homage. Well, not it doesn't. Again, I don't want to burst anybody's bubble or give away too much. I want you to go see this in the theater and enjoy it. But there's when it's a mature, well-made picture, not something that's cheaply shot and quickly. I think you respect it more. You enjoy it more. It's easy to put in, there was, of course, we are of a certain age. I remember seeing Halloween in the theater with my father and older brother. Parenting. But,
yeah, that's a scary one when you're little.
I was eight. So, but I mean, then there was the slew of Friday the 13th and then a slew of knockoffs of various, and you can tell the quality of the work. But this is really quality work. Like the films of Edgar Wright, of course, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, mm-hmm. Baby Driver, Scott Pilgrim. But I use Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead as an example. Those were so well made and very, very specific that I didn't need to see another zombie film for 10 years. And another, although I do like the buddy cop films, so they still make those. Mm-hmm. And in the case with Baby Driver, it's the heist film, and I like heist films. But this, what the two subgenres of horror that Mr. Peele has made with us, I don't need to see another one for a good 10 years. It's that well done.
Okay, it's you mentioned The Shining.
Yeah.
And pull me back on track here if we get way too out of bounds.
That's all right.
So a couple of years ago, the book, and the author's name is escaping me right now, Ready Player One.
Yes.
Which is a gigantically awesome homage to everything
80s.
From our childhood.
Yes.
And one way or the other, we did not see the film in the theater. We recently saw it on TV.
Okay.
And so when you mention The Shining, we just recently, I mean, one way or the other, there are certain films you just go through your life and you don't see them.
Right.
Amy and I had never seen The Shining up until about maybe, it's been within the last 12 months. So the wonderfully absurd things that people can do with computers and on film these days, they got so much right with that hook in that direction with The Shining and mm-hmm. Ready Player One. And it's not like Spielberg doesn't know what he's doing. but my goodness, is The Shining just like its own. It's like, okay, we're playing Jax over here, and someone else is building a nuclear fission reactor.
Yeah.
It's like you're not operating in the same thing. So having seen The Shining and then Ready Player One, to take those elements and put them into one thing that just is everything wonderful about your childhood. And we've talked a lot about how things are, you know, you see something as a kid, it's great and it's wonderful. You revisit it in 20 years and it's like, I don't know how I ever got out of high school. There's such a one, 'cause I don't seek out a horror movie.
Right.
I guess it's easy to qualify The Shining as a horror movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's certainly scary, but there's just so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a wonderful, wonderful time. And that's where I didn't see the name of Peele's first movie.
Get Out,
thank you. Because I keep wanting to say This Is Us. That's a completely different thing.
Totally different thing.
So I'm just wondering, is he going to have a follow-up called Them about giant radioactive
ants? No, it's going to be about a band with young Van Morrison as lead singer. See, this is also our lunch conversation. But there's a few moments in the last third of the film that look like, and not just The Shining. There's room images that's like straight out of 2001.
Yeah.
Just a wide scope, vast, of a particular space. So, the other thing that should be noted, as I mentioned, two of the names in the film, Lupita Nyong'o and Elizabeth Moss. Again, not giving away, everybody because there are two subgenres, there's a lot more to the acting in this with everybody involved. You have the mom is the matriarch and the heroine, and really, well, of course, but she's on the poster, but she's the one that takes charge. Dad does dad jokes and is kind of the dumpy father image that Peele could have played it.
Right, that was what I was going to ask. Are they doing it to the point where it's like it's by rote that it's sitcom dad, or
it's sort of dad jokes for days, and as the film goes on, the needed release of humor pays off. It really pays off in a number of moments. There for a long time, and this was probably after the third Nightmare on Elm Street film, where I didn't need a monster giving me James Bond like quips as it's
right.
Slicing and dicing, and I know the purpose of that is, well, you can release some of the tension. No, screw that. I want to be tense for 90 minutes if you're going to make a horror film.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand it's like the roller coaster of up and down and having those moments of levity and then you go in. So they also do that very well, as did Get Out did. Winston Duke plays the father. You have teenage daughter that's, you know, earbuds and phone and uncare, and then the youngest son who wears a monster mask on top of his head when he's not actually wearing it. The other thing about the family dynamic of these characters, there is not a weak link. When you have an ensemble, there's especially in a horror film, because sometimes you need victims to pick off one by one.
Do you mean as a character or as a performer?
As a character.
Okay.
As a character. I mean, everybody in this cinematic family has something to do.
Mm-hmm.
They will have something. They're not just standing there screeching or running or running and falling down kind of thing.
Right.
They are intricate to the family survival. I'm just going to leave it.
Yeah,
at
you're,
that.
Yeah, so, you're getting close there.
I know. So
without seeing it, I know you're running your limit of what you want to divulge here.
So if horror is not your first genre or your fifth genre, go see this one because it's
right.
really good, and then you won't need to see another one like it for a long, long time.
Well, it's so nice to see someone who at least gained nationwide popularity through comedy. I've always, you know, you give me a really strong comedic performer, they can do just about anything.
Yes.
Because of the highs and the lows and the range that they have to demonstrate, whether it's as a stand-up comedian or as a sketch artist performer.
Mm-hmm.
that, I mean, and I suppose Robin Williams would be the easiest example of that. So, I mean, not to say that comedy first performers are only good at that,
right?
But I just think that I mean, because Peele's a funny dude.
It's gotten easier. I'm glad you mentioned Robin Williams, because there is still an element of pigeonholing when it comes to show business. So mm-hmm. The fact that Williams was one of the big ones to make the transition from microphone, not TV, because he was a stand-up comic first, then had the TV, didn't want the TV, and then made the film. And it took several shots. It took several attempts before mm-hmm. he found the right thing with Good Morning Vietnam. Sometimes it was too comical, but it wasn't funny, or it was too serious, and audiences were ready for that. There was a big junk. I remember going to see World According to the Garp when I was 12, and my dad warning me, he's like, "This isn't Mork and Mindy." I said, "Yeah, well aware of that. Let's see what it is." And I went, "Oh, it's that." I will get it more, I think, when I get older.
Was that too early in his career? Because I've not seen it for probably a decade at mm-hmm. least, but all I know, my memories of that is it is a fantastic movie.
It is
top to bottom.
But I think the first big one was Popeye, and right.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
I'd like to rewatch that though.
And it's Robert Altman, it's Harry Nilsson, and you know, you're working with Shelley Duvall, and you know, something. It was an opportunity. I will mm-hmm. get that. So then to shift gears completely and do something like World According to Garp. So, but there were films like Club Paradise and Seize the Day and The Survivors, and they just weren't quite.
Robin Williams had a movie called Seize the Day.
It was a film, I think it was done for cable, where he's the traveling salesman. It was a drama.
So he has a film called Seize the Day,
and then later in
Dead Poets Society.
I'm gonna verify that for you.
But that's a wonderful little arc of within a career.
That's right. You're right about comedic actors being able to do, and part of it is as we tell students is, you know, you have to be, it has to be as if you're absolutely serious if you're selling a joke or selling a bit.
Right.
Seize the Day, yeah, 1986, right after Club Paradise, Best of Times, Survivors. Moscow and the Hudson was good. I like Moscow and the Hudson.
I was a fan of the Best of Times, actually.
Is that Ron Shelton? Yes, Ron Shelton wrote it.
There you go,
Ron
another sports movie from
Kurt
Ron
Douglas,
Shelton.
Or Kurt Russell, sorry. Anyway.
Different movie there.
Different movie. So anyway, that is that. So go check out Us. The other one in theaters is called Gloria Bell. It's a new film from Julianne Moore, who's also an executive producer on this. And it's a free-spirited woman in her 50s and basically loves dancing at various nightclubs and she's a divorced lady, and she meets a divorced man played by John Turturro. This is directed by Sebastian Lelio, who last year gave us I have a brain freeze, sorry. Did the film A Fantastic Woman, which won Best Foreign Film. Disobedience, that was the love affair film with Rachel Weisz and Rachel McAdams. Mm-hmm. And this time around, first American film. So watching a film like this, Bob Bloom, my fellow film critic, he made a great point of saying 10 years ago, 20 years ago, this was the star Diane Keaton. This would have been a major rom. We are now seeing more romantic dramas and romantic comedies with older actors, which mm-hmm. now that we're older, I'm like, yes, let's see this. However, because it's Julianne Moore and not Diane Keaton, and it's not a major studio picture, it's not teehee, old people are naked, teehee, old people are being silly. Although there's even a trope that has been used in certain films about aging characters, and they don't do this in this one, is, oh, look at the old person smoking grass.
Exactly.
There is some grass smoking in this film, but it's not played for laughs. The intimate scenes with her and Turturro, if you're a fan, well, I'm sorry, it's not going to open in 3,000 screens. And
sure.
And it's shot not in an ooh way, not in a funny way. It's shot in a kind of voyeuristic, intimate way. The thing that also the film makes transitions in time without second unit shots telling us what season it is or what location they're in. So that's a great example of watching this in the theater because all of your focus is there. If you're watching it at home, it's you against the house.
Right.
And the other people and beings that are in it, pets, other people. So your phone. And so this is the type of film you could easily, you look down and check something and then you're like, okay, where are we?
Mm-hmm.
So don't do that. Don't do that. But the other thing that's cool about this film is it is still about her even when the Totoro character shows up. It is not a will they or won't they picture. He is a part of her life in this little cinematic bubble of Gloria Bell's world. Surrounded by a really good cast, Jean Triplehorn, Michael Cera plays her son, her ex-husband's played by Brad Garrett, Holland Taylor plays her mother, Rita Wilson, Sean Astin has a cameo. The other part is she sings along with songs in the car, and I have not heard A Little More Love by Olivia Newton-John in quite a while. Now that's an earwig that is now Andy shaking his head, which means the song is now buried in his brain like the earwigs in Star Trek III.
No, it's just you mentioned Olivia Newton-John.
Yes, we are of a certain age.
And I'm going to check out for about 5 minutes, and I'm still in the chair.
But I'll take care of the show, no problem.
Okay.
But yeah, there's that. There's Air Supply. There's dance music because it's an older crowd. It's not Broad Ripple, and. Yeah, it had reminded me of my second newspaper job. My dear, dear friend Judy Harvey and Sean, who would later become her husband. Sean was the gentleman in charge of editing the page designs.
Mm-hmm.
So I dubbed him DJ Mengele because his musical choices were torture. He had every one-hit wonder, crap rock for a busy world, all that schmaltz, he had it on disc. And he would play him hard and loud on production day. And I finally sent Judy, my buddy Judy, a note about this after seeing the film, because there is a moment in the film where somebody at a party is doing an acoustic version of Gilbert O'Sullivan's Alone Again Naturally. Just like, god awful song. So
I'll take your word for that one.
I'm gonna play it for you when we're done here.
Okay.
So yeah, all that stuff. He would play it in our anyway. So anyway, really good performance from Julianne Moore, surrounded by a really good supporting cast. It is an independent film about a woman. It is not a major studio will they or won't they.
Mm-hmm.
So that's out there as well. So you got two really good choices post Oscars. And if you need a break from the superhero films.
Does Julianne Moore have an Oscar?
She does.
She does. What was that for?
It was for one of the least seen films of recent memory called Still Alice, where she is a linguistic?
A linguist.
Thank you. And she has a rare form of early Alzheimer's.
That's right.
Alec Baldwin plays her
four
years ago. So,
okay.
Yeah, so she's got one. She's already got one, you see?
Alec Baldwin.
It's very nice.
Alec Baldwin would be another performer with a lot of range from comedy to drama.
Yes.
A big swing.
And game show hosting. And politicizing.
He's a neat guy, and like a lot of us, he has issues.
He's a magazine rack filled with issues. So anyway, those are out there. Of course, Captain Marvel is still out there and Shazam is coming soon. I'm sure those worlds will collide eventually. Let's see. Shifting gears for just a little bit, depending on when you're listening to the show, of course, at IU Cinema on Saturday, March 23rd at 4:00 as a part of the City Lights film series. I will look at Andy as I say this title because that means, have you seen this? From 1967, Cool Hand Luke.
No. It's on the list.
We'll add it to the list.
Soon.
It's all right.
It's on
a
Netflix.
Never-ending list.
For better or for worse, it's
is
on
it
Netflix.
Really?
It is. Right now it is.
Well, I know they just the AV Club of The Onion, they in their news section, they do have a list of what will be going and what will be coming every month with Netflix. So I did not know that. Okay, so yeah, there you go. Enjoy. Mm-hmm. Eat eggs while watching it.
Yeah, I know about that scene.
And have Amy wash the car. You're welcome. Sorry, Amy. I've done that joke with Mrs. Sosie.
There we go.
Yeah, she's... pats me on the head, gives me a cookie, and I go on my way. Japan from 2002 is at 7 o'clock. Sunday, March 24th, Miss Akasi at 1 o'clock. Fly Me to the Moon at 4 o'clock. Monday, the 25th, Silent Light at 7 p.m. Tuesday, the 28th, Our Time at 7 p.m. Friday, the 29th, an interview with filmmaker Carlos Regadas at 7 o'clock, and then Carlos's film Battle in Heaven at 10 o'clock. Saturday, March 30th, Light After Darkness at 4 p.m., In the Life of Music and Rupture at 7 p.m. Anyway, all of those are happening. And then, this is the remake. I'm sorry. Thursday, April 4th at 7 p.m., Straw Dogs. It's Rod Lurie's remake, not the Sam Peckinpah version. I'm out. Over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, if you are listening to this first thing, at 2 and 7:30 p.m. on March the 23rd, Galaxy Quest.
We were just kind of fooling around with that earlier today.
Were you?
Well, you were involved in that conversation.
Well, that's
digitally.
True. That's true. Oh, yes, the thread of that, yes.
It's like 75 deep now.
Yeah, it is. And then I threw some Gateway in just to see if everybody was paying attention.
I must not have been because I missed it.
Well, it's on there.
All right.
And of course, full disclosure. So I've been giving Andy and Amy some movies to borrow because I'm the guy of, you haven't seen that? Here, take it. Go watch this.
Yep.
And, my batting average is slightly above the Mendoza line, maybe.
Deliverance was so good.
But you watch Boogie Nights at the same day.
It's an interesting double bill.
Bert, that's about it, really.
Well, right, but it's but again, it was kind of like Deliverance. You know, I'm well into my 40s and still had not seen one of an icon of American cinema, Deliverance. I mean,
yes,
I love a movie that's hard to watch, and it is wonderfully difficult. It is just...
And not just the scene, capital T, capital S.
And see, and that's the problem with that, is that, I mean, I'm, you know, for as much as I can be entertained by watching Deliverance, I can also sit there and watch Talladega Nights, for crying out loud. So
yes.
There is some lowest common denominator in me, but I would much rather be challenged than be spoon-fed a line of... garbage that tastes like cake. But so I don't know what analogy that makes to what Deliverance must taste like, but it was difficult to swallow. Man, change the subject. Oh my
yep.
God.
Yeah. Well, and it's man versus, well, besides man versus nature, it's man versus man, and then man versus conscience. And
that's the thing, is that's where, and you touched on just briefly on the whole superhero vibe that we're all somehow managing to keep our head above water for a little while longer.
Right.
The Thanos character, this whole struggle of, I know what I'm doing is right,
mm-hmm.
and I'm compelled to do it, and I'm sorry if you disagree with me,
yep.
but I still have to do it. And so when we see a good script and we see the characters really struggling to succeed, or if they're self-destructive characters, whatever it is, it's like I'm so glad to see that Jordan Peele wins an Oscar so early in his life. I mean, I say
career.
Early, he's career. Thank you.
Yeah.
That starting with a good script is mm-hmm. probably a good place to start.
Yes.
So when it's there we go. Now bring it back because I went out of bounds.
First it was Deliverance. Then it was my record.
Your
of
record
showing
with the movie.
Because I know, yeah, the last two were Burt, the Burt Reynolds double feature, literally, of Deliverance
right.
and Boogie Nights.
Within hour, back to back.
Speaking of films that are hard to watch, I think the very first one I made you guys watch was The Square. about the the art gallery in Scandinavia.
And even now, no, because there was that fun moment of, did he give us this because he really likes it and he thinks we'd like it? And it's like, man, we really don't know anything about Matt. But it, and then afterwards, as we as you told us,
I had some splaining to do.
It was a little spoofy parody. It's like an art house parody of art house films, I suppose.
Right, and I had just written about it as a. It was my.
That's right. There's
a
blog about
it. Blog,
that's correct. So it was hard to watch, but there was. But even if it's something that you can't identify with,
mm-hmm.
you can still tell when something is made really well.
Yeah,
and it's like you shared a link a couple of days ago to the. For Queen winning best film editing.
Oh,
and
I
watched that, and it was that the guy basically breaks down one scene.
Way too many cuts.
Yeah. And it's so interesting to me, because it's one thing I can appreciate someone's, I don't want to say craft necessarily, but that's, mm-hmm. that's a fair word to use there. But when someone, it's refreshing to see someone do something because they know it's the right thing to do or it's the right direction to go
mm-hmm.
instead of, oh, look, it's Barney the dinosaur running a unicycle and, you know, making cookies or something.
Sure. Okay.
If that makes any sense. But what was the road trip movie with Costner and...
Oh, Fandango.
Yes, that...
That's a favorite of mine from way back.
And there was a turning point for me. That was one that was really fun for me to watch because I'm not... usually into the frat kind of movie. I'm not usually
right.
into the
bromance of, and it's much more than that.
And it's part of that could be that I never had, because I did not go to college. I didn't have that tight circle of male compadres, so to speak.
Sure.
I mean, I had friends, and I've got four brothers, but there was a wonderful turning point in that movie where it went from, oh, man, this is, okay, it's another one of these. And then, and I, off the top of my head, I can't recall exactly where it was. But there ends up being this nice, there's an internal sense of maybe duty to one another, there
yep.
of community, of family. And,
correct.
And they find this mutual respect and, you know, to do something for someone because it's the right thing to do and not because they're asking for it. To help someone who genuinely needs help
yep.
is, and then to see that, I mean, just in real life, that's great and well and good and all that. But in a movie, because it's fake, essentially, it's a nice, that's where that film turned for me. It was,
cool.
And I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Good. So I mentioned this because, as I previously mentioned, Galaxy Quest is happening at the Artcraft Theater. And now that you guys are free from Young Frankenstein,
mm-hmm.
I really, and I've mentioned this, I want to watch it, but I want to watch it with you. Because we haven't had that experience yet of watching a film together at the house. But
right.
the documentary Trekkies. Which I
and
think
somehow
is
I've still never seen, but yeah,
we'll take care of that. So anyway, as I mentioned, Galaxy Quest and Trekkies, that's a slam bang double feature that mm-hmm. you can have at home. So anyway, that is happening at the Artcraft Theater on the 23rd. Speaking of Kevin Costner, Friday, March 29th and 30th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. a 35mm print of Field of Dreams, and then Thursday, April 4th at 7:30 p.m. the documentary Hitchcock Truffaut, about the conversations that between those two filmmakers. And then April 4th through the 6th at the Historic Artcraft Theater, the Alfred Hitchcock Film Festival. It will be, hold on, let me pull up the poster here. Man Who Knew Too Much, Marnie, Shadow of a Doubt. I've got to lean in. Strangers on a Train, Rear Window, and The Trouble with Harry. So not the most obvious choices. Couple of hits, and well, they're all hits. But
I've never even heard of that last one.
Of Trouble with Harry?
I'm not thinking.
His
think I've heard of it.
One of his dips in the dark comedy. A small New England town where a corpse is found. John Forsythe, young Shirley MacLaine, even younger Jerry Mathers.
Oh my gosh!
Yes, I might have to. I also have it. So anyway, we'll work on
wow.
that. So anyway, that is happening at the Historic Artcraft Theater in Franklin. New on DVD and Blu-ray this week. this is we are now in now that we're post Oscars and now films that have won and are nominated had been nominated will now get a larger audience because they're out to, for curiosity's sake. The film that was, if you were going to do any betting, which I don't recommend here at Film Sociology, all of our picks and predictions and our analysis are for entertainment purposes only.
Exhibition.
Yeah, but the one that one slam dunk that was a no-brainer was Best Animated Feature, and now out on Blu-ray, Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard every single person that has seen it says the same thing.
Yeah, it is whether you know the universe or not. Like my smarter two-thirds saw this film. Neither one of them are comic folks. Neither one of them have really fans of Spider-Man, but the link. Or the kind of what got him in is we are all fans of John Mulaney, who's great as Spider-Ham. But, yes, there is that. There is Nicolas Cage as film noir Spider-Man, and there's Spider-Girl. There's all of the characters that have happened in the history of the Spider-Verse all thrown in together with a young man who there's a lot of radioactive spiders apparently in town biting people, and they all get together and fight crime. And so you don't have to know any of the history of the Spider-Man saga to enjoy this. It's also visually fun. It may get a little too fighty, maybe the last 20 minutes or so, which is a lot of action films. But the humor of it and being able to be your own hero, that's a message which came with a film I saw earlier today, which I can't mention yet, is kind of similar to that as well. And if you're a real snarky person, Spider-Man winning Best Animated Feature also broke the Disney Pixar winning streak. So
okay.
There is that.
Does that go back to Shrek before they
I'd
started that up again?
I'd have to check and see. It was a long one. It was almost like the All-Star Game in the 70s. I knew you'd kind of get that.
Do you, should Into the Spider-Verse, am I getting the title right?
Yeah, Spider-Man and the Spider-Verse.
Should it have... had best picture consideration?
I don't know that far. I don't think that far. And it's not that because there have been animated features that have won. I don't think it transcends. It's fun as hell, but I don't think it transcends into the big category.
And it's hard for the big category. Fun movies.
Yes.
They certainly very
comedies,
rarely win.
Kinda,
but
yeah.
Every now and then.
They'll get one. And now that you have more options because... Everybody has to get a participation nomination. Sorry. I still think there should be five. I'm sorry.
I want to make a documentary called Watered Down, my goal to get into the best picture category.
Very fun. Also on DVD and Blu-ray, and this was one, this Spider-Man made more money than this film, but it had a bigger push, and Spider-Man became a bigger surprise. Mary Poppins Returns with Emily Blunt, and saw this with the family. Enjoyed it. I did. And I liked it because I thought, okay, here we go. Another Disney sequel, not a remake. Another Cockney accent that mastered this time by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Sorry. It's so easy. But it is the title. This time it's Emily Blunt. And it has the spirit of the first film. And there's some music moments that are homages to some of the earlier songs. It's not going to replace it. It's not, yeah, and I think especially when you have younger folks, you're going to show them, if you've not already, the original. It adds to it, but it's not going to replace it. Although the one, and the one moment that still tickles me, and I heard about this, was we knew Dick Van Dyke had a cameo in this. Angela Lansbury is in this as well. But there's the film itself is shot like a modern musical. There's, you know, it's not quite Baz Luhrmann heavy editing, but there is some of that. When we get to the one cameo with Dick Van Dyke as the head of the bank, the camera pulls back and it's a full shot, and we get to see a 93-year-old man still hoofing after all these years. And I believe there was an interview with Miranda who said, first time they met or first time they rehearsed, he offered his hand and Dick slapped it. So, you know, there you go. So anyway, it's fun.
No, Julie Andrews cameo?
No, she has.
Okay.
Didn't need to. But it's
a question. If I'm putting that movie together,
Of course you're going
to
ask.
Someone has to ask that question, do we ask?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm sure they did, but not in this one, so it's okay. Also out on DVD and Blu-ray, on Criterion, the 1945 film noir Detour, so it will be cleaned up and it'll look really cool. Anyway, that is happening. Oh, a couple older titles I didn't think. You can now put anything on the Blu-ray, which is fine. From the Warner Archives, I will have to pick this up, the original Cleopatra Jones, starring Tamara Dobson and Shelley Winters. That's my wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. And as we were talking earlier about Fandango, which in a way was kind of publicized, it was promoted a little bit like a kind of Porky's bro fest, and of course it's way more than that. Another one that is pushed like a bro fest, but there is some really human moments in it, is a 1983 comedy called Losing It. Here's the story. It's four high school kids in the early 60s going down the Tijuana, and they wind up tagging along with them is a woman who's going down to Mexico to get a divorce. And there's the shenanigans because the boys want to, well, do the title of the movie. There's a younger, brother that wants to get some fireworks. and of course, shenanigans happen because they're gringos and it's down in Mexico.
Hi, my name is America Johnson. I'm here for fireworks.
Right, pretty much. Well, here's your... And I remember seeing this in 1983. One of the star of the film of the, because you have the various degrees. You have the kind of jerky guy, and then the kind of the horny kid, and then you have the sensitive kid. The sensitive kid was Tom Cruise. The
wow.
divorcee, Shelley Long.
Wow.
The guy who, and there's a one who he, one of the characters who believes in the myth of Spanish Fly and wants to get it, is a young Jackie Earle Haley, but not as young as Kelly League.
Jackie Earle Haley, help me out.
Kelly League from Bad News Bears.
Oh, okay.
And the film was directed by Curtis Hanson, who would later make The Hand That Rocks the Cradle,
mm-hmm.
L.A. Confidential,
mm-hmm.
and go on. So there's some nice moments with Cruz and Long. And that helps balance out the drooly knuckleheadiness of the other boys. So it is a horny teenager movie, but it's got a little heart to it. And I'm sure Judd Apatow is probably, hopefully, if he hasn't cited this as an influence, hopefully he should.
Right.
So anyway, that is out on a Blu-ray. I want to mention this. Mill Creek Entertainment sent me a couple movies recently. I know, tough world. But Andy, your view on the spaghetti western?
I've never got into that a whole lot.
Okay.
As a kid, my dad certainly liked watching
the trilogy.
Well, I don't think John Wayne's films qualify as spaghetti westerns.
No, they
do
not. No. That's meat and potatoes westerns right there.
I don't know that I can speak even unintelligently about a spaghetti western.
Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Fistful of Dollars, Few Dollars More.
Are those the only three spaghetti westerns?
No, those are the ones that automatically come to mind.
Right. I've seen bits and pieces. The closest I come, honestly, that I could speak well about would be Rango.
No.
Which is
a
wonderful movie.
Yes, it is. And that film loves its spaghetti westerns.
Absolutely.
From guitar and
tone. I was
tone
just thinking
and
of that. Yeah, the guitar.
Less is more, or as my old roommate Gail would say, they're not saying anything. Yeah, I know. There's very little dialogue in these.
Okay.
So anyway, and no, I'm not going to flood you with spaghetti westerns yet. Sorry, Amy. I know there's that other element. What did Ceci bring you? now out on Blu-ray are a couple of films, because you had the gold standard, of course, are the Sergio Leone films,
right.
As I've mentioned, those three: Once Upon a Time in the West, Fistful of Dynamite, and then you have what happened in Italy a lot is if a particular genre did well, then Italians, even more than Americans, remade the hell, just made knockoffs on them. Think about all the Hercules films from the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a slew of Hercules movies. And the same thing with the spaghetti westerns in the 60s and the cop and mob films of the 70s. Mm-hmm. Which was, of course, later made. Mike Malloy, my buddy and guest on this show, made a fun documentary called Eurocrime about that particular genre. But back to spaghetti westerns. But then you had people like Sergio Corbucci, who made probably the B-level westerns. And what happens a lot, of course, shot in Italy, filmed by Italians, shot in Italy, sometimes shot in Spain, so long as you get something that's kind of deserty. You can have the united colors of actors in it, a lot of Italian actors with generic American names, which we'll get to in a minute, or if you got an American star in it, and maybe the rose is off their bloom in Hollywood, but they can get work in Italy, and then you sometimes have German actors and Spanish actors, and it's all dubbed and it's all good. So,
sure.
Two of the films I got to watch, and the back of the Blu-ray box says they're two of Quentin Tarantino's favorite spaghetti westerns. I have not checked to see if that's actually accurate, but it looks good on the back of the cover. From 1966, Fort Yuma Gold, which these films also have various miscellaneous, various titles, alternate titles. So,
okay.
But this is one that's set in, and it's all, oh yeah, one of the alternate titles, For a Few Extra Dollars.
Oh. Any which way, but not quite that loose.
Right. Kind of like that. So, wow. Where we have, it's the end of the Civil War, and a captured Confederate soldier leads Union soldiers to help fight the fort's, there's the crazy major who's still fighting the war even though it's lost, and he's got a big gold reserve, and so the guy's going to help try to get it out. That lead is played by actor Montgomery Wood. He's really Italian. Oh, but that's...
I see where you're going
with
that now.
Young, good-looking guy, can do some good physical work. And, you know, like, there's a scene where he can flip over a guy in a bar fight as he's charging at him. So he's nimble on his feet. That's pretty good.
So it's like Gene Kelly from
Singing
in the Rain.
Yeah, not as athletic as Mr. Kelly, but yeah, there is that. The other one is called Damn Hot Day of Fire, also known as Gatling Gun from 1968. And this is one where the inventor of the Gatling Gun, Mr. Gatling, and his prototype are kidnapped, and we have soldiers that have to find and retrieve both said items. Robert Woods plays our hero. Non-American. But there is one American actor of note in this, playing a half-breed, their words not mine, John Ireland. Yeah, so I'll show you pictures later, but there's a wonderful moment where his character, not really a spoiler alert on a 50-year-old spaghetti western,
nope.
but his character dies, and as there's a close-up of John Ireland dying, you can see his dark makeup, and I stopped Emma coming down the hallway, and I went, look at this man's eyeliner, really dark eyeliner. Not as dark as yours in Edwin Drood, but similar.
Oh,
yeah.
Cultural appropriation happening there.
That's really okay.
Yeah.
But, and there's a pocket watch homage in Hot Day of Fire. That's it's an homage to A Few Dollars More. So the other thing with the B-level ones, and Sergio Corbucci did this a lot with Django, the Django film, the first one, is one of the selling points to the spaghetti westerns was that they were more violent and that they were grittier than the John Wayne counterparts. So story-wise for both of these, they're kind of, okay, these westerns could be done. So from a grubby standpoint, okay, what have they done to make these films grittier? Use of Gatling gun in Hot Day of Fire, and this is 7 years before Outlaw Josie Wales, which had a really stirring Gatling gun scene. But digging a bullet out of your own hand, that's fairly gruesome. And there's a woman getting stabbed. That's a bit harsh. That is kind of frowned upon with American audiences. The other one that cracked up is usually the scores of these films are done by somebody imitating Ennio Morricone with the use of guitar and twang and vocalization. The Hammond B3 organ is the main instrument in this. So it's spaghetti western meets 60s jazz. It's really odd.
Wow.
But and then for Fort Yuma Gold, the Montgomery Wood character he's tortured by not giving up information, but he's staked to the ground two blocks put over his head so he cannot turn, and his eye are clamped open. So when the sun comes up, going to basically turn his eyeballs into grapes.
So, raisins.
Raisins. Well, yeah, eventually, though.
Eventually.
We'll start as grapes and then end up as raisins. So anyway, those are the
circle
two.
Of life.
Those are the two. Right. Those are the two gritty moments that happen in these two not bad westerns. Not vital, but if you're into spaghetti westerns, you will probably enjoy that.
You know, give credit where credit's due. When someone can come up with
a new way of
doing something,
inflicting agony on somebody,
and maybe it's an easier way. Well, what if we tie them to horses, and the horses are those kinds you used to ride in the front of the drugstore, and you put a quarter in them, and sometimes you come up with a good idea.
Only if Jennifer Connelly's writing it in Career Opportunities. Anyway, shifting gears. But, well, the story is Sergio Carbucci also did a film called Navajo Joe starring a young Burt Reynolds. This was around the same time as the Clint Eastwood films. And Carbucci was fine. He's a guy who's staked to the ground and left for dead. And, of course, he's freed, and he's going to exact revenge on everybody.
Right.
You know, spaghetti western. And Reynolds has told the story where he's like, I've broke their necks or everything. And he's like, and he finally says to Carbucci, how else can I kill them? And Sergio Carbucci, who had no English on his tongue, all he said was dynamite. And so there's a lot of dynamite explosions in Navajo Joe, starring Burt Reynolds. Okay, getting to dead people we like, because we never have time for dead people we don't like. Character actor Richard Erdman passed away earlier this week at the age of 93. And what's fun is his resume goes all the way back to the Twilight Zone, all the way back. He was one of the prisoners in Stalag 17, but he was best known most recently as one of the students as Leonard in the sitcom Community. So the fact that guy.
Yeah.
Classic that guy. 1953. Yeah. Billy Wilder also appeared in Anything Goes in 1956, Tora, 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 1970, The Men, one of Brando's first film back in 1950.
Wow.
So, yeah, really
That's
cool
so
stuff.
Far back.
And, he was the one, his big Twilight Zone episode, a kind of a stopwatch. One with the stopwatch that stops time.
Oh, wow.
And then he
okay.
can go and do stuff. So.
Well, and there's a connection for the Twilight Zone with David Cobine having just directed the Young Frankenstein musical. I had David as a science fiction lit teacher my senior year of high school.
Wow.
And one of them, and it was a fantastic class, Ray Bradbury, Twilight mm-hmm. Zone. I mean, there was a Twilight Zone textbook, essentially. It was a collection of, not all of them, but a lot of them. It was a fantastic class.
And, of course, the reboot of the Twilight Zone, hosted by Jordan Peele.
Right.
It all comes, look at that. See,
there
folks,
you go.
This is, I wish I had a cheeseburger right now. But the other passing in the film world, John Carl Buchler, not Blucher, but but this was a gentleman, this was a director and also a special effects artist, but kind of known more for the special effects maybe than the directing. But I will say, he did do his first major film, his director. Well, he did a segment of The Dungeon Master from 1984, but from 1986, he directed the first Troll film. Not Troll 2, but the first Troll film.
Is this the one with the little bitty guys?
And Julia Louis-Dreyfus, among others, is involved in this. Later, he then did Cellar Dweller in 1988. He directed Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood in 1988. Yeah, I didn't see it. You kind of know where the films are going now.
Well, I missed the first six.
Right,
I don't
so
want to be
miss
lost.
Subtle, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Watchers 4, in case you missed the first three. Deep Freeze, A Light in the Forest, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He's making those films.
I just hope Watchers 4's subtitle was Still Watching.
Still Watching. Thank you. Some of his prosthetic effects and special effects director credits include Dr. Heckle and Mr. Hype from 1980, Sorceress, Android, The Dungeon Master, The First Ghoulies,
That's the one I
think
was
did
thinking
all the
of,
Ghoulies
actually.
Film. Well, he did do Ghoulies Go to College, which was a video done in 1991. Cellar Dweller, Prison, Garbage Pail Kids movies, Dolls. God, all these. So many video store shelves had all of these titles. Bride of Reanimator. Oh, boy. He did the special animatronic effects, uncredited, on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Red Rock West. Dinosaur Island, Cyborg 3, Bikini Drive-In. Oh, these are, yeah, Blood Surf, Deep Freeze, The Mummy's Kiss, Grandpa's Place, Tomb of the Werewolf, and much, much more. So
this is why,
thank you, John.
Budding artists and creators, don't give up.
No.
There is room for all of you.
There you go. So, and with that smooth transition, you're listening to The Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Andy Dudas is hanging out with me. Before we get to Diva and the Department of Improv, as I mentioned at the beginning, Andy just finished playing Froerich Frankenstein in Richmond Civic's production of Young Frankenstein the Musical, which I can now say this on record. This was one of the great compliments I can give that show. It did not feel like 3 hours.
It was a long show.
It was a long show.
That is a wonderful thing to hear.
But it did. It did not. And so I have to ask, because I know you are a huge fan of the film, mm-hmm. as was I before going into this. I'm sure this was on your kind of own personal wish list.
Yeah, it's a bucket list role.
It's a bucket
right
list
there.
Role. Okay. Yeah. So now I'm going to ask. I'm really excited. Have you watched the film yet since?
Not carefully. We had a party after second Friday, and we had it running on
doesn't
the TV.
Count. That doesn't but... count. Okay. I'm really excited for you now because I've wrote about this in the Diva blog, but the first time it really, really happened with me was a week after I did Much Ado About Nothing at the Richmond Shakespeare Festival.
Mm-hmm.
It's just my own thing of once I do a show, then I will watch a film version of that show. Not really closure, not really, it's not a compare contrast,
mm-hmm.
but what was cool was it's a week after we get done, it's a Sunday morning. You know, my smarter two-thirds are asleep. I made a pot of coffee, and I put in Kenneth Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing, a film I had watched probably 20 times. I remember seeing it opening weekend with college kids, with college friends. It was the summer I had just graduated. So I knew the show, knew the film backwards and forwards, and had so much fun. And watching it after doing it changed my image of this film forever. Doesn't make it better. Doesn't make it worse, but because you had your own path with this, you've had your own experience with this character and this story, it's going to look and feel a little different
mm-hmm.
based on, again, film, theater, different meanings. We know that, but the fact is, okay, this happened, that happened. I remember when this worked, when this happened. And it's going to, so as I've written a blog that says, art doesn't change, we change. And you've changed. And you're going to be able to.
Right.
So I can't wait for you to have that moment, whether it's by yourself or with Amy, to sit down and watch it again because you're going to see it in a slightly different mm-hmm. light. And I think that's really cool.
Well, and because it's not. The film is not a musical.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see Amy's take on it as well, as Amy was the orchestra conductor and music director for the
right.
show. So it's. I'm trying to think of the only other time I was, let's see, again with David Cobine, I played Stanley Kowalski in A Streetcar Named Desire.
Yes, you did.
So there, with that role and then with Froderick, they're so identifiable, so
mm-hmm.
quotable. You know their rhythms, you know their tones. And there was, and it's kind of like, unless you can pull off a... Oh, his name is escaping me, from A Few Good Men, Kevin Pollak. Unless you can pull off a Pollak-level Christopher Walken, don't do it.
Right.
So there was that, in the beginning, it was, how do you approach a role that's that iconic and that quotable and that everybody knows? I mean, that's like, you know, him in that role, him in well, maybe just anything Gene Wilder did.
But no, but I mean, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, pretty much back to back.
Right.
I mean, that's,
I think that's only like 2 or 3 years apart.
I think so.
And it's so, and Young Frankenstein was actually his idea that he went to Brooks with, and then Brooks, well, sure, okay, and then they made it all happen. But it was, I've had a couple of people say that there's that kind of standard cliche, you made it your own. I got variations of that, and it's certainly wonderful to hear those types of things. And I had one or two people that came up to me with, "You were Gene Wilder," and I was like, "I'm taking that as a compliment every day of the week." But it was an interesting thing to hear because I was not expecting that because there was a bit of a goal of not.
I think you were physically looser up there.
Yes, absolutely.
Much, and I think. Here we are in the odd compliments. But you were like a noodle. You're also a very tall man, but you had more physicality, and again, musical's different. And we're not doing a stage version of word for word of the film,
right?
But you were able to be looser physically on stage.
There were some interesting things to discover. From the relationship between director and actor, between actor and character, and then the comparison between what I'm doing versus what everyone knows Gene Wilder has already done. So there were places – this was a wonderful role for me in the sense that even though it's the lead character and it was like something like 97% of the pages of the script, it was a gigantic role in that sense, a lot of stage time, but it to see how different things there's something to really be said, like what you're talking about, the difference between what happens live on a stage versus what happens in an edited film. It's you have to figure out sometimes even from the difference from one night to the next night with different audiences. In that lead role, there are places where I'm the straight man.
Oh, yeah.
And there, because, I mean, with Inga and Igor and Frau Blücher and even the creature and Kemp and Elizabeth, a lot of my stuff was just set up.
Yep.
And there was such a wonderful, and the improv has actually helped me to understand the difference between, when do I get to make somebody laugh? So I learned
the minute you stepped on stage, sir.
There you go. But it was fun to see, to learn how to just be the guy. Like I'm the wall that they're bouncing the tennis ball off of.
You were scoring points and getting assists.
Hey, how about that? So, yeah, it's like a hockey player. But
yes, that too.
But it was so much fun to discover a character that, because I had early versions in my head of like, I can't do a good Gene Wilder, so I'm not going to do it. So it's like, maybe there's a whole lot of Charles Nelson Reilly that needs to happen with this role, or maybe some Rip Taylor. And I couldn't figure out how to really jump into that into the pool.
Only if you end up with Igor, really.
Well, with JD, you never know. And that would, hey, not that there's anything wrong with that. But it was, in the end, there were these fun little bits and pieces of, because Wilder's portrayal is so straight that the reason that movie works and works so well and his characterization works so well is because he's playing it like it's the Grapes of Wrath.
Absolutely.
He's playing it hard
and
straight.
That's why him early on, you know, a word. I did not expect the first time I watched it to hear the word doo-doo. So there's that. He uses that into his argument. And the other great setup,
the
great setup, of course, Quiet Dignity and Grace. and then the pause, the turn, and the attack, which we can't say on the air.
No.
But the fact that he is absolutely straight, or the, you know, do not open this door. And then the turn from extremely serious to just bat spit anxiety.
It was fun to hear from the audience the anticipation from the people who know the film.
Oh, yeah. It's like watching. Well, you had that also with Spamalot to a certain degree.
Right.
Of, you know, here we're gonna, you're here.
Yeah,
the
you
audience
know what's coming.
Yeah.
It was.
Can you give an example where you could hear the audience getting ready for?
Well, it was specifically the "Do not open this door" speech.
Okay.
I could hear it growing each day. And they're like, oh, and it's not any one specific line is funny in that little hunk of dialogue. They just know that I'm about to lose my crap on the other side of the door.
Thank you for saying crap.
Yeah. That was the one scene, the internally as a performer, you go, man, I never got that one right. I just never got the handle on that. Was the one that everything else felt really, really good. Mm-hmm. And that one was like, felt good enough.
Kevin, you mentioned Kevin Pollak. I remember him talking on, I think it was on Bob and Tom, but the fact is when he would have to do the walk-in.
Yeah.
And he said, as a comic, you're supposed to, you're supposed to introduce new material. And the fact that you now it has to be, and he goes, I could hear the chairs scooting that, you know, here it comes. It's, you know, almost
right.
it's his free bird or something.
Absolutely.
I will say this, and I have not talked to David about this. And I probably should have. I'm sorry. But I thought for a brief period, because he does in his curtain speech, he has the audience. Mm-hmm. Sound off. For half a second, I thought we were going to be the horses.
Oh.
I wonder. But then I think that's more of a Rocky Horror feel to it.
And I heard other cast members making that kind of connection between, of which, again, haven't seen that film either.
No,
I know.
Okay. Well,
but it's David is a retired English teacher.
Yes, he is.
And he loves to teach. So when we did Streetcar, I think this is the fifth show I've been with David, because David gave me my crack into – David pulled the curtain back on this portion of my life when he cast me in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So it was – let's see, Oklahoma, Streetcar, All My Sons, Mystery Veteran, Drood, and Young Frankenstein.
Who were you in All My Sons?
I was – I think his name was George.
The neighbor,
the brother.
Oh, the brother. Okay, all right.
It was a tough one. It's a fantastic play. Is that Neil Simon?
No, Arthur Miller.
Arthur Miller. Whatever.
Oh my God, wow.
I don't know.
No, now I want Neil Simon's All My Sons.
I'm faking it.
The planes crash. Get out of here. You'll get out of here.
I'm putting the pro in amateur.
My wife did it at IRT. She was the
neighbor,
the crabby neighbor. Yeah, because I occasionally, you know, nothing melts a man's heart by hearing his wife go, "Jam," and her Rosie the Riveter hair. So
it was an interesting role experience for me, in that the story is fantastic. I really, really like the story a lot. My character was in one scene, and that's it.
Yep.
So it was difficult for me to find a continuity or a chemistry with the rest of the cast, even though I interacted with, I think, three or four others in that one scene. Mm-hmm. It was difficult. It was still a good show. It was still a good production, I think. And I think the best looking static set that Civic Theater has had on their stage. I mean, Phil Harp and Carvin Reinhart kind of. Mm-hmm. Pooled their collective abilities there and basically built a two-story house on the stage. It was fantastic.
I directed Marty Hancock, folks.
Right.
But as we were rehearsing in the annex, it hadn't really clicked. But I saw him on, and I'm like, oh, that's that. And he came in. I'm like, is this All My Sons? And he goes, yeah. And I said, I recognize the house. I was like, that's how I recognize. Like, well, okay. There you are, shirt sleeves outside. That's probably, I'm going to guess that's All My Sons. And sure enough, it was.
I'm a fan of the drama that has no set changes whatsoever.
I'm with you on that.
That's a fun one.
Yeah.
Or easier one, I should
exactly.
say.
Exactly. Okay. Before we dive even deeper, I do want to bring up the Diva Space, which mm-hmm. is now available for gatherings and whatnot. But you and your lovely wife, Amy, mm-hmm. wanted to open a space where there can be another chance to have an art experience in downtown Richmond.
Yeah, it was born out of the idea of, I mean, Amy and I, our lives, one way or the other, found each other. Our paths joined. That's
yeah.
not a weird way of saying that.
No, that's fine.
Our two paths became one. So through Richmond Civic Theater. And Amy has a lot of stage managerial experience through her days in college, and she is a wonderfully talented musician. And she's had her hands in the nonprofit arts scene in Richmond for many years. And it kind of became this, well, if we've got the Richmond Shakespeare Festival and Civic Theater and the Symphony and the Community Orchestra, why can't we do our thing? So that eventually became what has become the Dudas Inspiration Venue for the Arts, so that the whole goal is to never have anything that's too permanent, whether that be in theory or in physical structures. That, I mean, once you're inside the four walls, it's kind of like it is a reconfigurable space that you can use and do with how you need to or whatever you want to find. So we've kind of come across the idea of it's how you define art is how we define art, because it's easy to look at painting and photography, sculpture, singing, dancing. Those are very easily acceptable definitions of the word art. But it could be anything, and whether it's a carpenter or a bartender or a storyteller, a poet, any of that stuff. And mm-hmm. So the space exists for essentially long term. We hope to see it being used by outside groups more than our own internal stuff, because it gives people the opportunity to have a performance space, an exhibition space, or even maybe in some instances just a gathering space. And it's meant to be there for the community. So the idea is to not make a bunch of money. We're not milking people for the money.
I don't want to make any money, folks. I just want to do art.
I just love to sell the art. There we go.
Nice. Now you'll get something from Don's lawyers saying that you
right.
can't do that.
Well, you will. The opinions of the guests of the film show are not necessarily the opinions of the host.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've had some inquiries. We've had one outside party use the space, and we're still in our interim space, as we call it, which we are bound by fire code to a lower capacity number than we would like.
Sure.
But safety first, second and third.
And we've been getting sell-out shows every month.
That's right. You know, you increase the demand when you limit the supply, I suppose.
Something like that.
We've had a lot of real nice input from people, and there's something that's interesting. Just in a town that is hovering somewhere in the mid-30,000s as far as population, mm-hmm. and I just looked this up the other day, I think Richmond peaked at population at about 40,000, or I'm getting that wrong now, somewhere in the 60s. So one way or the other, attendance is, you know,
sure.
we're kind of like the Cleveland Indians in the the 60s,
wow.
the 70s, and the 80s, and the early 90s.
Dime beer, nickel beer night.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll pay you to drink our beer. So it's ultimately a labor of love, which is a overused cliche, but it also, in the end, selfishly, it gives us an opportunity to do what we think is art, what we think, not necessarily, we don't think we have, you know, what Richmond needs is blank. It's not that necessarily, but we are also driven by the idea of what can we offer that Civic Theater, because of its mission, cannot. What can we offer that is maybe a little out of the typical framework of what a semi-conservative community might find to be normal fare? So while I don't see nudity happening anytime soon, I'm always ready to, I mentioned to Eric Marsh,
yes.
At WCTV just yesterday, everything is on the table at Diva. So
cool.
It can be a little bit of anything.
And speaking of which, of course, the first Friday at the Diva Center in downtown Richmond,
yes.
is the Department of Improv, where mm-hmm. they do two shows, 7 and 9. This has been going on since October. And
September. Even.
September, sorry. And full disclosure, I'm one of the members. Mm-hmm. I occasionally pop up there from time to time. But But yeah, we have a gaggle of performers from really different backgrounds.
Yeah.
That come and perform once a month.
We have an attorney. We have the husband of an attorney. We have radio personalities, plural. We have a disabilities advocate. We have someone who is a retired journalist, someone who is a retired journalism professor. We have people who are still teaching. We have
one of the coolest King Lears I know. Hi, Erica.
Exactly. I'm sure I'm leaving someone out. I know I am because we have physicians.
We have
doctors.
We have somebody who doesn't know what a typewriter is. Kidding.
It's okay that they're going to outlive us by 30 years. You know, so they've got that going for them.
Yeah.
But we through your better half.
Mm-hmm.
And through a generous grant from the Wayne County Foundation, our budding nonprofit of DIVA applied for and was gifted a grant to pay for a improv workshop through the lovely and talented and well-read, well-bred. How can we describe Lynn?
Are you describing my wife?
Yes, your wife.
We're not going to go there. My she's again smarter two-thirds. She's the smart one. She's sitcom wife. She's I'll just be over here. But yeah, she did some improv workshops with the gang.
She we endeavor to do her proud every time we go out. Sometimes we're bunting. Sometimes we're sometimes we pop two foul balls and then we look at a third pitch.
Andy, like me, likes to mix art and sports whenever humanly
possible.
So,
but there are times, you know, we've got a YouTube channel. Just search for the Dudas Inspiration Venue for the Arts on YouTube. We've got a handful of, you know, 2 to 4 to 5 minute scenes that we find some decent ones because again, we are not professionals. We are. It's community theater improv,
yep.
And one way or the other, we must be doing something right because so far, we've sold like 98% of our seats from day one,
right.
And it's gone really, really well.
And we have two more shows: the first Friday in April, so that's coming up.
April 5th with Ed De La Paz, who is one of our super fans, and he's just an all around fun, nice, great guy. And then May 3rd, Beth Herrick will be our celebrity guest. It's a fun little thing that we kind of, one way or the other, we happened on the idea of having a guest performer with us every month. We tap into different pockets of the community, and they bring their friends or their family comes. And so one way or the other, we're getting different bodies in the space every month.
We're not seeing our friends or relatives. And hey, there's...
We've already annoyed them with all our jokes.
Right, yeah. They heard it.
Yeah.
So now we can't, of course, talk about ticket prices because it's public radio, but where can people go for tickets and information?
They can go to imadiva.org/calendar. And actually, if you just want to go to imadiva.org, that's all the information you're
going to need. I'm stunned
that
we got that title. I thought it'd be I'm a Diva, you know, 320.
Well, it was, when we chose the acronym, when we went for the name and we chose the acronym, we had to be really, really careful to not accidentally, there's a fun blog I wrote about this, to not become the Dudas Bureau for Arts and Gathering. And that's a bad acronym you don't want.
Right.
So... Once we figured out what our name was and the acronym was, then we started shopping around to see what domain names were available. And obviously, Diva dot whatever was long gone.
Sure.
And if you accidentally mistype a couple of things, I'm sure you're probably going to go to websites that have absolutely nothing to do with what we're doing.
And don't do that at work.
I wouldn't.
No.
But IMADiva.org would be a fantastic thing for you to do while you're at work, especially when there are funding sources in the higher ups that would love to see the arts flourish in Richmond.
There you go. So come check that out. Of course, we have a blog that Andy's written stuff, I've written stuff, and anyway, it's out there.
A lot of good stuff on there.
There is. I do want to shift gears a little bit. We're in the home stretch on this. Of course, time's not an issue, but there is one more dead person we like because we never have time for dead people we don't like, And anytime, of course, I can mix the other show I work on and this. But I do want to wrap things up by paying homage to the creator of this. Of course, that's Dick Dale. The song title is Miserloo. I know people call it that song from Pulp Fiction.
Right.
And that's okay.
Where I was introduced to it.
Well, as for most people, for a lot of people, that's where it came from. And that's okay. That's cool. He was known as King of the Surf Guitar. He passed away earlier this week at the age of, I think, 81. And besides the blues show, I love surf instrumentals. I love surf rock, and I love rock and pop instrumentals from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It's a lost art. They don't do those anymore. And so I knew about Dick Dale way before Mr. Tarantino's work came into play. But I also want to thank Quentin, because Quentin, as you know, watching his films, he will revive a career like a John Travolta, like a Pam Grier, like a Robert Forrester. And then because of his eclectic soundtrack choices, he's able to bring back careers, or at least bring them to a wider audience. He did that with Al Green, with the use of Let's Stay Together in Pulp Fiction, and he did that with Dick Dale. He had two of his songs, most notably Miserloo. And it is now forever going to be associated with, it's a great song to kick a movie off. Can't play what Amanda Plummer and was screaming before that, but it is a great intro, and it'll be associated with cool, hip, kind of borderline dangerous stuff. It's been parodied. I believe there was a parody of it in Space Jam or some in it, but it's one of those. It's like we were talking earlier about spaghetti westerns. People will hum or whistle the theme from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, never seeing it, mm-hmm. but they know that song. And Miserloo and Dick Dale is in the same ballpark.
Well, as we mentioned, Rango earlier.
Yeah, right.
Now, is that music that emulates Dale, or was that Dale?
No, that emulates actually Ennio Morricone, the film composer.
But there's, from the unassociated layman's point of view,
right?
There's some crossover.
Oh yeah,
they're just so fun to listen to.
The twangy guitar, yeah, absolutely. And Dale was known. Dale was considered the godfather of heavy metal because of the tone of his guitar.
Okay.
The sound of it, the speed of it. And this is, we're going back to the early 60s. This is before Zeppelin and Cream and Black Sabbath and all that. So he had a huge following in heavy metal, had a huge following in punk. Dick Dale would play the Melody Inn in Indianapolis at least once a year, and it was always sold out, it was always packed, and it was always loud as hell. And after he died, there was a secondary article that kind of came up because there was an interview with Dale saying he literally had to keep touring in order to cover his medical bills.
Oh.
And that's another discussion for another time.
Yeah.
But the fact is that a gentleman with an 8 in his age is giving you one of the loudest shows you've ever experienced. And hey, so he is immortalized forever in pop culture. And I think we're all the better for it.
Absolutely.
So
okay. So how do you feel about from Joe Lunchbox walking down the street?
Uh-huh.
Beach Boys music versus Dick Dale.
I'd pick Dick Dale.
Well, I don't mean. Well, no, of course.
Are you doing one or the other?
No, I just mean in the sense of is it kind of like someone who follows and is very familiar with Dick Dale's work. And then there's the Beach Boys. Oh,
yeah,
it's
them. There would be a little bit of that. There would be because it's
there's a place for the Beach Boys.
The cute surfer boy. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Let's never forget, Pet Sounds. Pet Sounds is one of the greatest rock albums ever made, and that was the one that the Beatles heard it and went, oh, we need to step up our game. So they made Sgt. Pepper. When it came to instrumentation and also the harmonies, no matter, say what you will about the surfer, you know, about the Beach Boys, those vocals,
those are pretty,
yeah, and they're solid. So and kind of like the Beatles, Brian especially, you know, by the time we get to the mid '60s, he was tired of doing songs about cars and girls. He wanted to do something else. The fact that they had a single called "God Only Knows." That's fine now. By the way, it was used in the trailer for Toy Story 4. So,
which looks kind of dark. I'm hoping this isn't Crystal Skull. Oh my God.
I don't think there's a refrigerator for Woody and Buzz to hide in, but we'll, anyway, that's another time for another time. But no, they started getting by the mid '60s with Brian kind of shoving them into it. They were making albums as opposed to making singles. And so,
do you see that as a good thing or a bad
thing? Yeah, no, I think it's a good thing.
Okay.
And it's funny because the other gentleman that passed away, Hal Blaine, who was the drummer of the Wrecking Crew, also did a number of Beach Boy tunes, playing drums for them. So yeah, you can. I think they can exist. Obviously, they exist on the same beach. But Pet Sounds is an amazing album.
Something
that.
That's popped into my head though.
Yeah.
A couple things that you've mentioned kind of brought something that I've discovered this past week. I believe it's SB Nation on YouTube. You mentioned for someone who has an 8 in their age.
Yes.
Were you aware that you have never seen in your lifetime a college basketball player with a 6, 7, 8, or 9 on their jersey? First or second digit.
Why?
Because it's a rule. You can't.
Why?
Because when it comes time for the ref to go to the scorer's table and tell them what number committed the foul, it has to be 5 down to from 0 up to 5 because they gesture to the bench. So you have never seen in your lifetime number 27, or you've certainly not seen number 78 because that's
really?
Just the rule.
Just in basketball?
In college.
College. Okay, all right.
But then, of course, that gets into the conversation. It's a wonderful YouTube channel because they come up with these really arcane rules about, there was one about how Stabler fumbled the ball forward again
right.
and again and again. And it's like, yeah, we're not going to do that next year. But that also got
Waited the... Waited, thanks, Snake.
Right.
well, that's
while
like
when, he was probably smoking in
yeah,
the huddle,
yeah, I bet he was hungover and just couldn't hang on to the ball.
But
that was like when they adjusted the mound because of Bob Gibson back in 68.
Yeah. You're so good, we're changing the game.
Yep.
We're changing the surface of the playing
mm-hmm.
field. So, and it's there's talk about maybe pushing the three-point line back because Steph Curry just is in the parking lot. And just
it can
out.
Do that.
And
just chuck
that.
Him away. So
but it's... But no, I thought of you instantly when I saw that video the other day. But beyond the 6 through 9 digits in college basketball, in international play, I think it's 1 through 12 or 1 through 13,
mm-hmm.
whatever the capacity of the roster is. Those are the only numbers that are allowed on the team. You can't be number 33 in international play.
Wow.
So when you're watching the Olympics, that's why Jordan was number 6 on the Dream Team, I think. But it... the things you never think about that you, why would that not be a thing? And why is it a thing at college and not in the pros? Well, mm-hmm. probably because they actually pay the guys in the pros. Well,
right.
They pay them
well.
Really
they pay
well.
Them
I mean, there's
more.
Not, it's not Mike Trout better. Money. But hi, my name's half a billion. What's your name?
yeah, there
once
is.
Once you hit
that.
A ball that far, you catch and throw. Somebody's willing to pay you.
It's a very simple game. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball.
Yep.
You got it.
It's,
and I can't do the rest of that line because...
What is that from?
Bull Durham.
Ah, we just watched that.
Scare
them.
They're kids.
Right.
I'm going to watch... Actually, I should be watching that now that the season has officially started.
Yeah, they played in Japan the other night.
But Criterion put it out on Blu-ray.
Bull Durham?
Yeah, for Bull Durham.
Yeah.
And I thought it was funny because, you know, when you think Criterion, you think the cream of the crop of cinema, the avant-garde, the foreign. And occasionally they'll do something... Well, I remember, like, they did The Rock and they did Armageddon. And they did RoboCop, but they also did Bull Durham. You're right.
Well,
I mentioned a title that made you.
Well,
made
no,
you
you mentioned The Rock, which I am a giant Sean Connery fan.
Yes.
The Rock, I could deal with. Armageddon, I could not.
No.
It's called Deep Impact. Look it up. They were better than you.
No, no Aerosmith ballad.
But, oh, hi, my daughter's here. She'd like to be in the... sorry. She's an actress in her own right, but whatever. But RoboCop, what a fantastic movie. Oh, my word. It's so wonderfully over the top and bloody, and just Peter Weller, who showed up in Star Trek Into Darkness as the bad guy.
And our and our current favorite colonel, of course. What?
Peter Weller?
No, no, RoboCop. Not kidding. We'll I'll show you after the show.
KFC.
Yep.
I've not seen that.
I'll show it to you. Trust me, it's not directed by Paul Verhoeven, so he's not blasting.
The chicken's not exploding
not
in the bucket.
He's not blasting in the bits. So, gosh. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, trust me, we could go on for hours and hours. But speaking of which, since you mentioned Sean Connery, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
I remember inflicting Zardoz on the Zilix and Emma. I'm not ready to inflict Zardoz on you two. Especially
that's,
your wife.
That's the outfit, right?
Yes, that's the outfit.
It's like the holsters with the Speedo.
And another, like, why is he making us watch this? So, anyway, that's Zardoz has spoken, so I like greener people. Andy, thanks for hanging out.
Thanks for having me. This is always fun.
Good. We'll get you both on. It'll be like the newlywed game.
There, no whoopee will be had on
not on the air. No. Anyway, we'll get the doodie on a show. But yeah, go to imadiva.org for tickets.
Yes.
And the first Friday of the month, and of course the next weekend. No, 2 weekends.
Two weeks from today. But yes, the first Friday of every month, live improv in Richmond, Indiana.
Get your tickets now. Thanks, Andy. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
No. We'll do it live!